That one ended up pretty high.
Sorry.
You did fine. So tenor is a high part. Oh, you're good. Please stand, or take whichever posture works best for you in the honor of the gospel. Jesus put before them another parable. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to someone who sowed good seed in his field. But while everybody was asleep, an enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat, and then went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared as well. And the servants came and said to the farmer, "Did you not sow good seed in your field? Where then did these weeds come from?" And the farmer answered, "An enemy has done this." The servants said to him, "Then do you want us to go and gather them?" But he replied, "No, for in gathering the weeds, you would uproot the wheat along with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest. And at harvest time, I will tell the reapers, 'Collect the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" Then Jesus left the crowds and went into the house. And his disciples approached him, saying, "Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field." He answered, "The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed are the children of the kingdom. The weeds are the children of the evil one, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Just as the weeds are collected and burned up with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will collect out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all who bring about evil, and they will throw them into the furnace of fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Let anyone with ears listen." The word of the Lord. You may be seated, and looks like Tyler is going to be taking our junior worship kids with him. If you guys would sing with me. Jesus loves me, this I know.
Can you hear me? Is this good? Okay. Good morning. It is an honor to speak with you all this morning. And rather than focusing entirely on the passage from Matthew, I'd like to allow all of the scriptures that have been read today to kind of speak to us in different ways, pull out a couple themes that when I read through these passages really jumped out at me, and I read them all once, and I just kept on getting this refrain, and then I read them all again through that lens, and I think it really kind of ties it all together. So I'm going to be talking about these passages and other stories that came to mind, so just kind of come with me on this journey. If I were to title this, I don't know, this message, it would be that God works outside of our expectations. That over and over again, this theme of God is not bound by the limitations I put on him. So let's let's get into it. Let's take Jacob in Genesis 28. The passage details a dream that Jacob had, angels ascending and descending, God telling him, I will never leave you until I have fulfilled the promises I gave to Abraham, to Isaac, and now to you, promises to bless you and to make you a blessing for all nations. What a great scene. You have this ladder, staircase, whatever, a connection of sorts. It's a promise that God is restoring the damaged connection that happened at the fall. The fall caused a separation, a rift between God and mankind. And the resulting consequence of that rift is spiritual death, spiritual separation. And in this dream, God is promising to restore that connection. But that's not the point, I don't think. Because what about Jacob the man? What about him? The beginning of the chapter is nice. Isaac is blessing Jacob, telling him to go find a wife from Rebekah, Isaac's wife, from Rebekah's family. Don't marry a Canaanite woman. Esau, the brother, had already married a Canaanite woman. And when Esau realized that Isaac didn't like or didn't want his children to marry a Canaanite woman, he goes off and finds a wife from Ishmael's family, which is Abraham's first child, right? So we have this blessing. We have this realization. We have a ladder. It's a nice scene. But we have to remember that Jacob is running for his life. Chapter 27 details how Jacob was deceitful. He was deceitful towards Esau twice and Isaac. He bartered for Esau's birthright. The story, we know that, where Esau was out hunting, Jacob was making a meal. Esau comes and he says, if you don't give me something to eat, I will die. And Jacob's like, give me your birthright. And he's like, fine, what is a birthright to me if I'm dead? And then later on, Isaac is blind, and so they have this plan to put sheep's wool on the arms, because Esau was a hairy guy. And so to trick Isaac into giving the blessing that was designed for Esau. Isaac was blessing Esau in that story, not knowing that it was Jacob. When they found out the lie, the deceit, Isaac and Esau were furious with Jacob to the point where Esau was going to kill him. And then Rebekah was like, nah, you need to go get married somewhere else. Go, go, go. Jacob is running for his life. I can imagine that. I can imagine that when we look at someone like that, when I look at someone like that, when I read about what Jacob did, it's the last place you expect God to be. At least maybe if you're kind of trying to kind of get into the story, it's the last place you expect God to be, because this man did not deserve. This man was a bad guy, lying to his family, stealing the older brother's. I mean, there's a whole like historical thing I'm not going to get into, but it was a big deal what he did. But one phrase keeps on coming back to me that stuck out to me. Genesis 28 verse 15, God says this, I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. I am with you wherever you go. Jacob didn't deserve it. God was still there. But even that phrase, I am with you wherever you go, when we read that, we're like, duh, why, where else would God be? God is all things, all where, right? Everywhere. That's another one for you. Sorry, inside joke. So, dang it, I'm going to get thrown off. It wasn't your fault when I looked over at you, and now it is your fault. So, it's the last, like when we hear the phrase, I am with you wherever you go, we think, duh, where else would God be? But that's not the way that Jacob or anybody else really in the Old Testament would have understood where God would have been. In that time, in that culture, in that area, that ancient Middle Eastern area, gods only had power within the confines of the city-state or nation in which people worshipped them. And they lived in the temple. If you wanted to commune with the god that you were worshipping, you had to go to their house and commune with them. And we see this exampled even as late as 1 Samuel. If you wanted your God to go somewhere, you had to pack up the God and take him with you. Take him or her with you. In 1 Samuel, the beginning of 1 Samuel, the God warns his people not to fight the Philistines, but they disregard him and they pack up the ark and they take him to the battlefield. The Philistines win, they capture the ark. Israel is in shambles because their God has been taken from them. Gods are confined. But even way back in Genesis, God tells Jacob, I am with you wherever you go. I am a God that travels. Similarly, there's another story in which God says the same thing. David, King David, wants to build God a temple, because he wants to house God in this lavish place. The tabernacle at that time was kind of run down. David said that this is not acceptable. I'm kind of paraphrasing. I'm speaking into David's mind. But you can understand that David had such a close relationship and close connection to God that he wanted to give God the best. So he's going to build him a temple. And that way, David could go and be with God as often as he wanted. And first, God says, no, David, you are not going to build me a temple. I don't need a house. Because wherever you have gone in all of your travels, Goliath, with fleeing from Saul, in all of your victories, your military victories, I have been with you wherever you are. The expectation of gods at the time was that they were confined in the space. And God simply says, I travel. I go with you. I am with you wherever you are. And then David, I don't know the timeline, but it makes sense if David wrote Psalm 139 after this. Because he says, where can I go that you are not near? If I ascend into heaven, if I descend into Sheol, if I go out to the farthest seas, if I am in darkness, even then you are near. Even then you are here. Interesting thing about darkness. Darkness in the Bible is often associated with sin, or at least it is the time in which sinful things occur. Darkness is something to, if not be feared, at least not emulated. We are to be a light to the world, a city on a hill, a lighthouse, a beacon. We are supposed to let our light shine. We are called to be light, and by necessity, we are therefore not called to be darkness. And if sin can often be associated with darkness, then a common phrase that I heard growing up, and I was talking to my mom the other day, and she heard this when she was growing up, is that God cannot be in the presence of darkness. God cannot be in the presence of sin. But how many stories do we know, just off of the top of our heads, where God enters into darkness and then creates light and life? Genesis 1. God enters darkness and literally speaks light and life into existence. Jacob is dreaming at night. God is there with him, even though he probably didn't deserve it. God is there and he says, I am with you. Let me show you this connection that is going to be reshaped and reformed. Joseph in prison. Wrongly imprisoned. God comes to him in this time of darkness. And Joseph then becomes the second most powerful person in Egypt. Moses in Midian. It is not specifically stated that it was at night, but often fire in the Old Testament is used as God's messenger, as God's light in the time of darkness, and Moses encounters a burning bush. Jonah in the fish. Daniel in the lion's den. When Jesus was birthed into the world, it was in darkness. When Jesus was in the tomb, darkness literally eclipsed the sun. God does not fear the dark. So why is it that I often fall into the temptation or the trap in thinking that in order for God to be present in my life, I have to remove the darkness first? I understand that question maybe kind of comes out of nowhere a little bit, but let me try to explain. I said earlier that God cannot be in the presence of darkness, and I don't think that's entirely what the Bible teaches. If anything, a more appropriate claim is that darkness, sin, cannot be in the presence of God. But again, I mean, that is true. And I often fall into the thinking that that means that I have to do something first before I can enter into his presence. But I think that line of thinking is proven false as well. In the Romans passage, Paul does not say, become righteous and then you will be adopted. Or become righteous so that God will adopt you. He says, you have been adopted. The Spirit of God is already here. Now go live your life by that Spirit that now dwells within you. The Spirit is already here. Now go live your life. A parallel from the Old Testament. The Jewish religious calendar can be a metaphor that describes the spiritual journey of a follower of God, a child of God. There are major feast days throughout the harvest year that all center on the spring, summer, and fall harvests. The first kind of week of religious festivals is the spring harvest. You have Passover, Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the Feast of First Fruits. And the Feast of Unleavened Bread is when the followers of God at this time would remove leaven from their homes, even from the nation itself. And the idea is, leaven is often, but not always, associated with sin or corruption. And so you are removing that from your life, you are removing that from your home, you are removing that from the land. But that happens after Passover. Passover is when God saved them from death. In Egypt, when the plague of darkness was hovering over the land, it wasn't just that God turned off the lights. It was a physical manifestation of what it would look like, what it would feel like to be in darkness, in spiritual darkness, in death. It was a time of great fear for all of those who were in darkness. And it was in that moment, in that time, that the angel of death passed over the land, taking the firstborn. And those who had done the ritual, the lamb, the blood on the lintel and the doorposts, Passover, grace, mercy, redemption. Then the removal of leaven. It is not a prerequisite to remove the leaven to then get the Passover. Passover occurs and then. So often I think I fall into this trap that I must first repent, be transformed, and then God's presence. And then I'm allowed to be in God's presence. And I think that over and over and over again, the reverse is true. God enters, transformation occurs, and then you walk away from the life that you once lived, which is really the actual understanding or interpretation of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. They were leaving their old life behind in Egypt. They didn't have time to let the bread rise, which is why it was unleavened. But they were leaving their old life behind, and they were entering into a new life with God as God's people. God's presence, then transformation. Then you live the new life. God is already here. I just need to wake up and recognize that. And then concerning the parable of the weeds. Jesus very explicitly says that the wheat in that passage is the people following after God, and the weeds are the children of the adversary. He very explicitly says that. But is it possible to read that as maybe on an individual level? Paul talks about a spirit of flesh and a spirit of God that dwells within us. And sometimes the spirit of flesh causes me to do things that I don't want to do. And the things I know I should do, I don't do. And I can't explain it any better than that. Sometimes the spirit of flesh is victorious. Sometimes the garden that we have in our own selves is choked with weeds. Jesus does not tell the people, you have to weed the garden before the harvest. Jesus tells the people, the weeds and the wheat will be there at the harvest. You do not have to do the prerequisite. And that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense. Why would I want a garden full of weeds? I'm supposed to be my best. I'm supposed to be my best when I enter into the presence of the Most Holy One. God says, no, I'm already here. You don't have to come to me. I've already made that choice. I've already made that step. Just like Jacob, wake up and recognize God is in this place. God works outside of our expectations, but within our ordinary lives. God meets people before they become the people that God will change them into. I like that. God meets people before they become the people that God will change them into. And wherever you are, understand that God is a God that travels. These passages, these four passages that we've had, talk about the mundane. A rock in the wilderness, the groaning of creation, the routine of sitting and rising, lying down, a field with wheat and weeds. But they all become sacred because God is already there. If you are struggling with this idea that you have to first be perfect or clean or fill in the blank of the guilt and shame, just like Jacob did, wake up and recognize that surely the Lord is in this place.